believe in kidnapping.
I saw the whole thing go down. Okay, I work here.
Hey, man, check it out. Check it out. Mark's on TV.
Well, joining us is an eyewitness to the scene, an employee of the store who saw it all. Tell us what happened.
Well, see, there was this guy here. He kind of wigged out and everything, but that's besides the point, because we're having a get-together here tonight. There's going to be free admission, live music, kids, chicks, the full nine yards, man. It's going to be heavy shit here at midnight.
We're live on the air right now, sir. That's the story, kid. The gunman has
been apprehended.
Some shattered
here at midnight, party on, man. Damn updated. The man. Red save the empire.
Saw it on Linden Street.
Hello, and welcome to I Saw It on Linden Street, the show dedicated to finding the joy and appreciation of cult films, exploitation oddities, beloved classics, and all points in between. I'm your host, Chris Roberts, inviting you to join us here at the Linden Street Cinema Experience Theater, where we once again dig up a fun cinematic relic from the past. Now, if you're new to the show, thank you so much for joining us. This isn't your standard film review. Rather, it's a synopsis of a film that we feel deserves to have another inspection, with some background thrown in on the actors, information on the director, and hey, if I'm doing my job, perhaps you'll get a half-amusing story out of me. Now, fair be warned, while we don't cover all aspects of the plot, we do discuss endings and spoilers. So, if you'd like to be surprised, please give the film a viewing before you listen to us. If you like us, and hey, I would hope that you do, please recommend this podcast to a friend, give us a favorable review. This week, we are continuing our month-long theme, I Got the Music in Me, by screening Alan Moyle's 1995 Xenial Music Time Capsule, that is Empire Records. Join us! This week's film is one that's sort of a rare, non-Star Wars related movie that I can say I have seen well over 50 times. And honestly, it's mainly due to it being, this is the sort of film that we would put on in the background when we had friends over growing up. It was the kind of thing you would put on while you were debating what you were actually going to be watching later in the evening. Think of it as sort of the aperitif that you would consume before the main course even came. It was goofy, it was fun, it was endlessly quotable for us. And this is, I don't know if I would call this a moment of cool. When I went to college, I had some friends over to my dorm room to watch this film, and with my back to the TV, I managed to impress a few people when I was able to tilt my head without looking at the screen and in perfect time lip-sync along with Lucas delivering lines to the film from just sheer repetition of viewing.
Perfect. Well, not entirely perfect.
Empire Records was the cinematic tie that ended up binding the latter portion of Generation X with a group of elder millennials who decided to sit down and take in this film. It was an age to hearken back to, one that makes me completely nostalgic, and one that assuredly looks completely alien to all of the youth of the present day. That, and, well, honestly, the painful realization that all of the bands featured here are now considered to be classic rock, that quickly reveals to all of us that time makes fools of us all. Now, before I'm carried off on a complete wave of nostalgia where I start pining for the scent of CK1 and girls in miniskirts rocking Doc Martens, one really has to set the scene to understand how this film truly came to be. How essentially nobody would end up seeing it during its first run on the big screen. But honestly, if you're going to understand the appeal of this film, you first have to hip those who are listening currently, who missed out completely on the concept, to just what the experience was to be able to shop at stores like Tower Records. Now, for those of you who are under the age of 30, Tower Records was a small, inauspicious start of a company. Basically, it was a small record store that opened in Sacramento, California in 1960, and within 7 short years, it had expanded up the coast to San Francisco, and by 1978, it was opening a store in Sapporo, Japan. And from there, it went worldwide, opening stores in South Korea, Malaysia, Hong Kong, the Philippines, Thailand, Singapore, Taiwan, Israel, the United States itself, the Arab Emirates, the United Kingdom, Ireland, Canada, Mexico. They sold records, tapes, CDs, VHS tapes, DVDs, posters, and books, as well as a bunch of assorted cool collectibles. Tower Records truly was a cool place that you would go to back in the day for a host of different items. I personally recall it was a big deal for us to go out to Schaumburg when I was in high school and stop on the way at Tower Records when we were going to Woodfield Mall. And we would peruse their wares and make use of their listening stations as we would ogle various tchotchkes from back in the day that, of course, I could not afford. Seriously, if you want to get into more about the actual history of Tower, do yourself the favor and go look up Colin Hanks, that's right, Tom Hanks' son, 2015 estimable documentary called All Things Must Pass, The Rise and the Fall of Tower Records. It's an excellent watch. But suffice to say, it was this really cool place. It had cool people. It served as an inspiration for the setting of this week's story, mainly because the screenwriter of Empire Records spent her youth working at Tower Records. You see, in high school, writer Carol Heikkinen had a job at the coveted Tower Records in her hometown of Phoenix, Arizona. And it's from there that she transferred to work at the Tower Records during her college days in Los Angeles. And from these various workplace stories and the characters she would interact with on a daily basis, she ended up using them to be the inspiration for her pen screenplay, which she just entitled Empire. It was her version of capturing a single day in working at a record store. She would later admit in an interview that she took the inspiration from the 1976 film Car Wash, and she just inserted her own experiences into the mix. The story was rather simple. It was of an employee gambling with the store's daily take, and then a bunch of apocryphal stories that had happened during her own store. Employees were hooking up, having screaming meltdowns during shifts, getting high during the middle of a regular day. Yeah, you know, the sort of normal that happened when you were working in a place during a time. Hence, it's why this is considered so commonplace to have employees who, well, do things that we would now consider, of course, to be, well, multiple terminable offenses, and they get off instead with just some sort of beleaguered, "Ugh, please, just don't do that again." Above all, Heikkinen wanted to capture the atmosphere of a store that was basically viewed as a second home, and sort of an accepting second family for all of the employees who worked there. Now, the initial story of Empire Records was penned to be a spec script, and that was quickly picked up by agents over at the William Morris Talent Agency, who accidentally touched off a bidding war that started between New Regency Pictures and its parent company, Warner Brothers, over who was actually going to make the film, which landed what we would now imagine to be a rather insane deal for writer Heikkinen, because she would walk away getting $325,000 for her script, with an additional $200,000 back-end payday if they went forward and ended up shooting the film. Also, as part of her contractual deal, she would receive an additional 1% off of the soundtrack royalties they would tie in with the film, and 5% of any merchandising sales. On paper, that was amazingly savvy and forward-thinking to attempt they would try to cash in on any of those trends of the day, and that is a crazy deal for a new writer in Hollywood. Newly minted studio CEO Michael Nathanson wanted to make a name for himself at New Regency Pictures, and he saw the promise of taking this sort of script and how it had a story that could be made on the cheap, and what's more, it had the potential of having both a soundtrack tie-in and merchandising opportunities. Nathanson felt this was so good a decision to tap into the teen market that after 2 days he greenlit the project. He ended up being presented with a new film script from director and writer Amy Heckerling, who at this point had already had a successful run of delivering films like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Johnny Dangerously, National Lampoon's European Vacation, Look Who's Talking, and Look Who's Talking 2. She rolled in with a new project she had just penned. It was her take on reimagining Jane Austen's Emma, but she had set it in the trendy world of current Beverly Hills. Nathanson heard her pitch, and with all of the confidence of a serial killer, thinking that he had Empire Records in his back pocket, said, "Haha, sorry, but I already have a teen movie for Regency." So he turned down the small film that would go on to earn over $60 million at the box office. I'm sure you've never heard of it. It was called Clueless. Yeah, talk about short-sighted for sure. And no, I'm not mocking Nathanson for picking Empire as a film to make. I'm more mocking him for not being able to wrap his head around the concept that, you know, you can entertain two good movie ideas that were targeting teens in a single sitting. Well, I guess hindsight is 20/20 after all. Anywho. Regency greenlit the project for $10 million, and then moved to secure a director to helm the project. They'd want someone who is hip, someone who could tap into the zeitgeist of the day, someone who was able to clearly relate to the disenfranchised youth of Generation X. So who did they end up hiring? Alan Moyle. Now, for the record, I like Alan Moyle, even though his films have not always had a steady track record. It was clear he was being sought out by Regency for his work in directing the 1990 iconic cult film Pump Up the Volume with Christian Slater. It's a good movie, a fun movie, and a movie that if I showed it to any of my college students today, or at least my younger cousins who are of appropriate age, I still think it would be perceived to having aged like milk. On paper, the 47-year-old had the bona fides, but he was still trying to dictate what he thought filmgoers some 20 to 30 years younger than him were actually into, both through storytelling and through music, which really made this a hard row to hoe. Now all they needed, though, was a cast. And it's important to note that, with the exception of the so-called adult characters in the film, the bulk of this cast were a bunch of unknowns who really hadn't broke yet. But in a scant few years, several of them would find themselves helming projects of their own and garnering major attention. So let's start. We have Maxwell Caulfield showing up here, of Grease 2 fame, and I'll stand by it. It's a poor sequel, but a better film. He was cast as the aging pop star Rex Manning. Anthony LaPaglia, who had already had success in films like One Good Cop in 1991 and Innocent Blood in 93, was cast here as the very much put-upon store manager Joe, while his love interest was, of course, the marvelous Debbie Mazar, who had actually already starred as his girlfriend in the film So I Married an Ex-Murderer in 93. She was coming in hot off of doing some minor roles in films like Goodfellas, Beethoven 2nd, and Batman Forever. Now, the rest of this cast, again, at the time, bunch of unknowns. People like Rory Cochrane, Brendan Sexton, Ethan Embry, Johnny Whitworth, James Chemo Wills, Renee Zellweger, Coyote Shivers, and of course, Liv Tyler. The latter was felt to actually be a double win for production, because of course this is a film about music lovers, and now you're having it star the daughter of the lead singer of Aerosmith, who had just made a major splash starring in the music video for her dad's hit, Crazy. Making it slightly strange though, at the time, the 29-year-old musician-turned-actor Coyote Shivers was married to then-17-year-old Tyler's mother. Famous or infamous, depending on your stance, rock and roll groupie, model, singer, B.B. Buell, who at the time was 41. That must have created a very interesting dynamic for sure, hanging out pretending to be the same age as your stepdad. Tobey Maguire was actually considered for several parts in this film, and he ultimately didn't get a role. He still, though, was invited to come to the set, and he hung out for quite a bit of time with the cast, because he was promised by director Moyle that they'd try to find something for him. But when that didn't happen, Maguire just returned to LA, and, well, as we all know, he was never heard from again. Except for that string of Oscar-nominated films and a minor gig playing Spider-Man in a full-on franchise. I know. Poof. Vanished. The film was shot in Wilmington, North Carolina, standing in hard for Baltimore, from October through December of 1994. And it was shot on the same sound stages that used to belong to Dino De Laurentiis, and they're the ones where the film The Crow was shot, where, of course, Brandon Lee met his tragic end. Production basically turned a giant warehouse and converted that space into being a full-on street scene, building a full replica store and then building a bunch of, well, surrounding shops, putting in concrete, putting a working road. So really, it's just incredible. You see, they would have interiors that would be done on other sound stages that would allow actors to move from room to room and allowing them to have tracking shots. But really, when they're all in that main store area and they're looking out through the windows and you could see people walking around on the street, all of that is happening indoors, which is pretty impressive. You got people driving cars in there. The cast was put up in a series of duplexes on the beach, and the semi-remoteness of the area forced them to all hang out, spend time together, bond, having large meals each night with Moyle, and generally getting into certain levels of shenanigans. Brendan Sexton would go on to crash a golf cart into LaPaglia's brand new SUV. That didn't go over well. Ethan Embry got Kimo Wills arrested when he was goofing around at a Walmart. Embry had apparently just gone in and he had bought himself a child's cowboy-style cap pistol. And then he thought it would be a good idea to ride a coin-operated carousel that was outside in front of the parking lot, firing off the cap gun like an overgrown child cowboy. Wills had drove them there, and as they decided to leave and make their way back, they're of course pulled over by police who had been called by locals. But instead of focusing on Embry, who later admitted it was a good thing they didn't because he had a large amount of marijuana on him and was most likely high at the time, they decided to instead focus and harass the long-haired Wills. The officer questioned Wills when he pulled him over, saying, "I hope you don't think this is funny." But apparently he didn't like Will's response, which was, "No, I don't think this is funny. I honestly think this is stupid. I told him not to buy that cap gun." Well, apparently this sort of response was not appreciated, and Wills was removed forcibly from the vehicle and booked on, honestly, what seems to be a rather trumped-up charge, hindering and delaying an officer of the law. Production members tried to pay the fine and get Wills back to the set, but local police insisted that he was going to have to go through the process, get booked, and experience some time being jailed for a few hours before they released him. Haha, you gotta love small-town cops. Of course, the ever-famous shot was done with actress Robin Turney having to go through a very insane process of being super brave and shaving her head for real on camera while it rolled, which created a marvelous scene, but it did end up causing her issues as she was going to look for work in the next 6 months, necessitating her to have to wear a wig for the following movie she would film, which of course was the supernatural film The Craft. The studio partnered with its ties at A&M Records to cobble together a soundtrack that would feature a variety of B-sides and favorite tracks of what at the time were deemed to be, well, college rock bands. Something that could lean in and try to tickle both Generation X and current teen sensibilities. But Moyle wanted to also have an even larger and more diverse film roster to pull from. You know, there's a whole section cut as the subplot of the film that had Kimo Will's character Eddie running a mini vinyl store within the overall Empire Records store to justify the use of air quotes, classics. So over the course of the runtime, we have really over 50 different artists having their work featured. What we did get as the final movie tie-in for the soundtrack was 16 tracks featuring the following artists of the day: the Gin Blossoms, the Cranberries, Edwyn Collins, the Martinis, Toad the Wet Sprocket, the Innocence Mission, Better Than Ezra, Ape Hangers, Cracker, the Mises, Drill, Luster, Please, Evan Dando, Coyote Shivers, and the Cruel Sea. Amazingly, though, what didn't make the cut, including, in my humble opinion, some of the best tracks featured in the film from artists like Quicksand, The Ass Ponies, Real, AC/DC, Sponge, The, Poster Children, Flying Lizards, Dire Straits, and of course, The Buggles. After shooting wrapped, though, there was a serious case of post-production blues that occurred. For some rather bizarre reason, producer Nathanson and the studio brass at Warner Brothers started to doubt what they had just spent their money on, and they wanted to get some immediate feedback. You know, like you do with other forms of art. Are you sitting down? It would prove disastrous. Initial test audiences rejected the film outright, and that caused Regency to go into full panic mode and demand that various reshoots and cuts be made to the film. As writer Helen Peterson opined, the problem was an awkward one, because you had production being run by a bunch of baby boomers who were not really making any real effort to try to understand the culture of Generation X and its indie sensibilities, but at the same time, they were trying to market entertainment to them. Kurt Cobain had just ended his life, and everybody was looking to see who the next Nirvana or Pearl Jam would be to capitalize off of that burgeoning grunge aesthetic. Peterson would later make the connection that, much like the film Reality Bites that came out the year before, Empire Records was just the latest attempt of a major studio to try to reach a subculture that was notoriously resistant to direct address. The problem here, though, is Empire did not have the kind of hands-on talent with writer-director-actor Ben Stiller, who was able to speak to the project and defend the choices made, as well as being a member of the generation in question. Instead, they have Alan Moyle, who again, like him, and he was a competent man in the saddle, but he couldn't just simply assuage fears by way of conversation. As Moyle would look back on the studio interference, he would sum it up succinctly: the studio was in a cocaine mentality, and we were making a movie that was in a pot mentality. So what do? Well, they go into panic mode, and they start to micromanage. The film gets cut, and I'm talking hard cut. Moyle had initially delivered a film that would have been an R-rated comedy, and Regency instead insisted that it stick with a PG-13 sensibility, so they removed much of the drug humor and sex talk from the film. The studio insisted that they shoot a completely new opening, filming a prologue that shows the character Lucas losing all of the day's take of money in Atlantic City, and after those additions were made, they started trimming. Really trimming. For a film that was supposed to take place over a 2-day period, it was now pared down to a single day on screen. Entire story arcs or straight-up introductions to main characters at the time, for Jane, Burko, and Eddie, and even subplots involving Rex Manning, were completely jettisoned. When the cutting was done, a full 40 minutes of screen time had been removed, all over Moyle's protestations, and Regency had a version of the picture it finally felt was, air quotes, safer. There's going to be more about this, but heck, folks, you've been ever so patient in listening to me and my idle prattle. How's about I shut up and we get to that trailer? What do you say?
Just let me introduce you to everybody. This is Gina, Roy, Lucas, AJ.
The staff of Empire Records had the coolest jobs on earth.
Do you think the story is already written? Or do you think a bold and courageous act can change the course of history?
Something happened to me last night in Atlantic City.
Did you win anything?
No, I did not.
But Lucas blew it. Everyone knew it.
You were by Empire?
Well, that's a good thing, right?
The money is gone.
Where's it going to?
I think it's recirculating.
We're turning this into a music town?
I have to pay for what Mr. Brilliant here did.
I'm the idiot.
You're the screw-up, and we are all losers.
Now, five friends have one day to decide what to do with the rest of their lives. AJ loves Corey, not the whole story.
Today is the day that I'm gonna tell Corey how I feel about her. That I,
love her.
Yeah.
Do you think that it's possible for someone to be in love with someone else and not even know it?
In this life, there are nothing but possibilities.
That is so sweet. I think I'm gonna barf.
Corey wants Rex first time at sex.
Hey, Rex, what happened to your hair?
I will offer myself to Rex Manning. I wish I could be brave.
You are brave.
I have to bring Rex his lunch.
I'm bringing Rex his lunch!
Mark's raging mad. Best day he's had.
Just let this
If I was in a band, they would not be doing this to me.
Deb shaved her head and made out she was dead.
I tried to kill myself with a lady bit.
Just your typical nutty teenager.
You did have hair, right?
I was tired of being invisible.
Gina did it again, this time to a friend.
You get smarter the shorter your skirt gets.
I want to sing in a band, but I don't have the guts.
Is this how your life's gonna be now? You're just gonna screw every has-been?
I'm starting!
Wanna know more? Check out the store.
Empire Records open till midnight. This is Mark. Midnight.
Empire Records. Featuring the music of Better Than Ezra, Gin Blossoms, Ape Hangers, Evan Dando, Toad the Wet Sprocket, and the Cranberries.
What is wrong with you people?
Rock and roll.
We open on Empire Records, an independent store in Baltimore, Maryland, as longtime employee Lucas, as played by Rory Cochrane, is preparing to close the business for the very first time. His boss, Joe, as played by Anthony LaPaglia, has left very specific instructions. Count the money twice, keep his hands off Joe's beer, cigars, and drumsticks, and don't screw up. As Lucas helps himself to all three of these coveted treats, he accidentally stumbles across a contract for a Music Town franchise agreement, a corporate store that would no doubt attempt to purchase Empire. Making an incredibly rash decision, Lucas takes the $9,104 that was the day's take, and he jumps on his motorcycle to go to Atlantic City, determined to win enough cash to keep the store open and independent. He has a string of luck as he enters the casino, calling multiple wins as he walks through, and he manages to even win $18,000 at craps, impressing all those around him, before having some rather disastrous results.
Which match, please, ladies and gentlemen, we have bets down. We have a high roller.
9,104. I counted it twice.
I like your style.
Well, Joe told me to count it twice.
More bets, please, ladies and gentlemen. Bets down.
So do I just throw it and get a seven?
That would be very good, sir.
Feeling lucky?
I'm guided by a force much greater than luck.
Seven! A winner!
Baby, you are sex.
I know.
Same lucky shooter. Get your bets down, please, ladies and gentlemen. Hot shooter on the line.
You know what? Let it ride.
A dice coming out.
That's an $18,000 bet. You sure you know what you're doing, kid? I know this, that if I win this roll, I will save the place that I work from being sold and the jobs of my friends that work there, thus striking a blow at all that is evil and making this world a better place to live in.
Huh?
And I'll buy you guys a drink.
Hey, party. No more bets, please, ladies and gentlemen. Get your bets down.
Joe? This one's for you.
Two. Reps.
And a roll.
You know something? He used to be cute.
He used to have 9,000 bucks.
I wonder if I'll be held responsible for this.
Lucas is awoke the next morning outside of work by his friends and co-workers. The aspiring artist AJ is played by Johnny Whitworth, and the smiling stoner Mark is played by Ethan Embry. He ends up cryptically conveying to them that he has regretfully gambled away a large sum of money before he drives off. AJ already does the mental math and worries what the outcome will bring, but proceeds to open the store as normal when Joe arrives, grousing that today is Rex Manning Day, a promotional stunt where an aging 80s pop star, Rex Manning, as played by Maxwell Caulfield, will be on site to sign autographs for fans. Upon entering, Joe is quickly flooded with calls from both the bank and from his boss, Mitch Beck, as played by Ben Bodie, both of which are demanding to know why the previous day's receipts were not deposited. As Joe simmers quietly with rage, he shines on both parties until he can get some answers for himself. Fellow employees, overachieving student Corey, as played by Liv Tyler, and sultry Gina, as played by Renee Zellweger, arrive and clock in, excited for what the day potentially holds. Corey has decided that today is going to be the day that she offers herself up to her childhood crush, Rex Manning, and Gina, her spontaneous, see, loose best friend, encourages her to do so. As the girls arrive at the store, they encounter fellow employee Deb, as played by Robin Turney, a prickly, antisocial young woman who is already dealing with some very real depression and has just apparently survived a suicide attempt. While the employees are ready to open the store, Deb decides that this moment is the right time to shave her head in the employee bathroom, causing worry amongst her peers. Lucas arrives and awkwardly admits to Joe that, yes, he's lost the money, but his answers are less than satisfying.
Lucas!
Joe!
Where's the money?
Joe, the money is gone.
Yeah, I know it's gone. Where's it going to?
Atlantic City.
Atlantic City?
Yeah.
Is it coming back from Atlantic City?
I don't think so, Joe.
What's it doing in Atlantic City?
Recirculating.
Recirculating.
Are you pissed off, Joe?
Lucas.
Joe.
Lucas.
Joe.
Lucas, listen to me. I told Mitchell Beck that you forgot to deposit the money. I told Mitchell that the money was still here.
Joe, that's not true. It's in Atlantic City. I swear.
Shut up. Sit down and don't you move.
It could be in other cities by now.
Oh, shut up! Under no circumstance do I want you to leave that couch. Unless it's to get me $9,000. And then you bring it here to me, okay?
Joe, I think it's gonna be okay.
What makes you think that?
Who knows where thoughts come from? They just appear.
What a moron.
Completely enraged, Joe levels with the rest of the employees. Their boss was planning on selling them all out to Music Town, but Joe was going to come in and make him an offer to come on board as a partner and keep Empire independent. But now that plan is ruined because he's going to have to take that money and use it to cover what Lucas has now just lost in Atlantic City, all to keep the youth from going to jail. In a fit of anger, he shares the new rules that they were going to have to follow as now new Music Town employees.
No visible tattoos. No revealing clothing. We're both screwed. At least you're used to it.
No, Deborah, don't be bitter. Certainly with your ever-growing collection of flesh-mutilating silver appendages and your brand-new neo-Nazi boot camp makeover, the boys will come a-running.
Let's not fight, let's just rip.
In spite of their problems, the staff preps for the arrival of Rex Manning, with Lucas taking the opportunity to tackle and detain a young shoplifter who identifies himself only as Warren Beatty, as played by Brendan Eugene Saxon, who vows to get revenge on the whole crew as the police take him away, but not before Lucas has some fun at his expense.
Warren, look what you took. Rap. Metal. Rap. Metal. Whitney Houston.
It's for my girlfriend, okay?
Sure it is. You know, someone like you needs to diminish their criminal impulses, not magnify them. Maybe some jazz or some classical.
Maybe you bite me.
Rex Manning and his publicist, Jane, as played by Debbie Mazar, arrive and they start their autograph signing session, with Manning clearly not enthusiastic to be there. After sitting in on a conversation with some of the boys as to how they're not fans of Rex Manning, Jane decides that she too has had enough and quits on the spot, leaving Joe further frustrated. Mitch comes by to pick up the deposit for the bank, and Joe, still unsure of what to do, stalls and instead gives him a deposit bag full of flyers. While AJ awkwardly tries to build up the courage to tell Corey his feelings of love for her, the police come and arrest Warren to take him away, causing the teen to promise that he's going to get revenge on Lucas and the rest of the staff. Corey makes her move, bringing Rex his lunch and then throwing herself at him. And while he begrudgingly decides he will oblige her, she's rather horrified and then runs out and heads up to the roof to cry, right where she runs into AJ, who is just waiting to tell her how he feels. Unable to cope with everything at once, Corey ends up sending a dejected AJ away. Corey leaves to go get some food with Gina, and she ends up venting her frustrations to her friend, which leads to an argument between the two of them over Gina's perceived promiscuity. This causes Gina to rashly decide to seduce Rex as payback, which she does, having a tryst with him in the store's back office copy room, only to awkwardly be discovered by the rest of the staff. This happens, though, not before Joe finally decides to let his frustration about Lucas, the missing money, the store going corporate, all of that just flies, culminating with him punching Lucas, but then he at least quickly apologizes for it.
Now let me stop ya. Keep dancing, but you better do it now, because by next week, this is going to be a music town. And I don't think that they allow dancing in Music Town.
What are we supposed to do instead, Joe?
What am I gonna do with this guy, huh? What should I do? Turn him into the police? Send him to jail? Who do you think that he's gonna come to when he wants bail? Who? Me, right? Me. What should I do? Put in my own $9,000? And then I'm screwed.
Don't worry, Joe. You're a superb manager.
Really?
Superb.
Keep it up, Lucas.
Superb.
Say it again.
Superb.
Shit! Joe, that's my shoulder. Ow! Get in there!
You deserve that, you know it, right?
I know it.
As Gina and Rex exit the copy room in front of the entire staff, AJ becomes angry and jumps to attack Rex. While Lucas and Joe end up holding him back, Rex ends up punching the young artist with a rather cheap shot. This causes Joe to throw the star out, but not before all of the staff tell him how much they dislike him, mocking his hair, his music, and Rex ends up leaving the store frustrated and alone. Gina and Corey get into a screaming match, which ends with Gina spilling Corey's secret about being a successful overachiever through her use of diet pills, noting that she too could get good grades and stay up all night if she was chowing down on speed. The staff separate the friends, and Deb actually shows sympathy for Corey, taking care of her, and they end up sharing a moment where Deb admits that she sees that none of them really have it all together. She also puts Corey's misplaced crush on Rex in perspective, and they end up sharing a laugh about it. Jane ends up returning and asks Joe for both a job and to have dinner with her later, which he happily accepts. Things do manage to calm down, and Corey ends up throwing Deb a mock funeral to show her how important she is to the Empire staff family, and how they acknowledge her suicide attempt. Gina and Corey end up making up, creating some good vibes felt throughout the store, but the moment is interrupted when Warren returns, now brandishing a handgun at AJ and demanding to be taken seriously.
Joe! Hey, Joe! Did you see that? Did you see that? Wasn't that brilliant? Yeah! Did you love that?
You told me not to come back.
Well, here I am.
The gun, Warren.
I'll give you the gun.
Hey, what are you doing?
I wanted to have a little chat with Warren.
Yeah? Have a little chat with my gun.
What do you want, Warren?
Stop calling me Warren! My name is a fucking Warren!
His name isn't Warren.
Well, you can't kill me, Warren.
I thought his name was Warren.
And I talked to God, and she says, yo, what's up? And she wants you to lose the gun.
You're psycho. You are psycho. What the hell is wrong with you people? You all belong in a loony bin. Every one of you. Forget you guys. I don't need you. You think you're so happy and you're so goddamn great because you work in a freaking record store. You think you're so superior. Hey, Joe, Lucas steals $9,000 from you. You don't do dick to him. So you gotta give me a job now?
So that's it, Warren?
Want to work in a record store?
No.
I think you're lying, Warren.
He's not gonna give me a job, man.
How do you know?
Why should he? Why should anyone give me a job?
Gave me a job.
So do I get the job?
Well, considering the fact that he's a minor and he put blanks in the gun, there's really not a whole lot they can do to him.
Well, thanks a lot, officers. Take care, Warren. Stay out of trouble, okay?
Wait, take care, man. Wait a minute.
Warren, I made this for you.
Cool, man. Warren,
Wait. Can you keep it here for me so when I get back?
For sure.
Thanks, man.
Hey, Warren, take care of yourself.
With Lucas smiling, Joe does end up offering Warren a job. And while the police do come and arrest him again, since the gun was loaded with blanks and the staff are not going to press charges, he's going to be back, and he'll be back employed. The staff all gather around Lucas and begin to pool their money to replace the $9,000 that he lost. Deb ends up selling her scooter, Jane takes money out of the Rex Manning account, Burko is played by Coyote Shivers, and Eddie is played by Kima Wills empty their wallets, and even with all of the staff getting together, they can only scrape up $3,050. Lucas apologizes to them all, explaining he was only trying to save the store, and he offers to face the consequences. Mark gets an idea, though, and runs out into the street, interrupting a news crew who were covering Warren's attempted holdup, shouting on air that they're going to hold a late-night benefit to damn the man and save the empire. The staff prepares to put on a show, creating buttons, banners, securing kegs of beer, and hauling Burko's band's equipment and instruments up to the roof. Mitch arrives and starts screaming at Joe, but Joe tells him, quite frankly, that he just quits. He's going to start his own store without him. Burko then starts to perform and pulls Gina up to the mic to sing, and they end up performing the song Sugar High, much to the delight of the crowd. The money is easily raised, and Joe reimburses Mitch for his troubles, and the uptight owner offers to sell the business to Joe cheap, never wanting to own a record store in the first place. AJ, after spending all day fighting with it, finally gets the neon sign to properly light up on the roof, and turns to find that Corey has joined him, apologizing to him for pushing him away earlier, when she admits that she does love him, and then shouts at him that he's too stupid if he doesn't go to art school and pursue his dreams. AJ tells her that he does plan on going, specifically he's going to choose one in Boston, so that they could be together, and they end up sharing a kiss. The concert ends, the store is saved, and the entire staff ends up partying and ending the evening dancing on the roof, as credits roll. Ah, jeez, where do we even begin? Well, I gotta say, for the record, I do still really enjoy this movie, although I have to say, watching it now with almost 30 years of perspective, it's a complete hot mess of a film that doesn't hold up to really any form of modern scrutiny. And that's okay, I can deal with that. Part of that is due to the cuts, and part of it is just due to the triteness of the writing. To be fair to the film itself, though, all media and stories that are aimed at teenagers for a certain time frame is going to age poorly as culture moves on. So again, I'm freely willing to admit, you can enjoy the picture, but one just needs to be aware that it exists in a very specific, but very fun, bubble. to say that these characters are all sort of caricatures of archetypes, that's just being kind. Modern audiences watching AJ and Corey as a romance subplot will quickly point out things like, oh, I don't know, how much they're a terrible couple. He doesn't listen to anything she says because he's so self-absorbed with his infatuation, and likewise, she's a driven overachiever who's equally shallow and in her own world. That said, the relationship and how everyone else views it inspires some amazing dialogue during the course of the film. And, at least for my money, I'll say. Like, for example, Joe's dismissal of AJ's infatuation, like, yeah, it's a Tuesday, what about it? Good for you? That's phenomenal.
Now, I need to ask your advice. Now, I know you know a lot about love and women and all that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
My wife left me for another woman, and my girlfriend forced me to leave at gunpoint. Does this qualify me?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Look, Joe, I've decided that today is the day that I'm going to tell Corey how I feel about her.
Uh-huh.
No, I know what you're thinking, but I really am. I mean, I've been working here off and on for 5 years, man, so I've got to tell her how I feel, you know? I got to tell her that I
love her.
Yeah. Now, how do I do that?
You say I love you.
What do you want, written instructions?
If I find that kid, I swear I'm gonna kill him.
Okay. I'm gonna tell her this morning.
Good.
By noon.
Right.
Definitely. No, by noon or one.
Huh?
By 1:37 exactly, Joe.
Well, good luck.
Well, thank you.
Honestly, isn't Joe the boss we all wanted growing up? He's that big kid that maintains his responsibilities, he looks out for his employees like they're family members, but he still has the ability to let loose. Joe and Lucas really have a great father-son dynamic, although Joe clearly gets a little physical when he gets angry. Joe wants to, understandably, kill Lucas, but as the film runs its course, we get to see that Lucas was previously just like Warren, a frightened kid with nowhere to go. That is, until Joe found him, took him in, and took care of him. For all of his bluster and all of his rage, when Joe finds out that Lucas took the money, once his initial anger is done flashing, his first impulse is just to ask Lucas, "Are you okay?" He questions if the young man is in trouble, and while he's brutally honest about his rage with him, he does this again and again for each of the employees. He offers to be there for both Deb with her depression, and for both Corey and Gina with their respective meltdowns. The irony of all of this story, though, which we of course couldn't see at the time, our villain, if you want to consider Mitch the villain, is actually absolutely right. He wants to get out of the music business because he thinks this is going to be a losing venture for him. He could take a big money payout selling to a larger corporate entity, and he doesn't have to deal with any of this quirky behavior that an independent music store brings. This is, after all, a modified version of Breakfast Club set in a record store. And in the day, the draw for a story like this was to follow the kids and their individual strangeness, to let you identify with these various archetypes you saw on the big screen. That's the draw then. Watching it now, I'm more interested in sort of the logic that's indie store versus corporate buyout. Because knowing what we know now, and how the revolution with MP3s and streaming services would come through and completely destroy the music industry as we knew it, these giant corporate stores that this crew fights so hard against, they're the dinosaurs from a bygone era. And those few remaining gems of indie stores that have actually managed to survive that mass extinction that, well, all of Apple and iTunes brought, much like modern-day crocodiles, they're relegated to remain, holding down these coveted niche markets and areas, acting as living fossils to this day. Now, there are some glaring problems and a lot of questions that remain with this film. A few minor things make you question, well, I guess lots of stuff. You can write this all off as vapid or inept writing, or you can blame it on studio cuts, again, when you watch the film. But now that you're going and looking at it, things feel glaringly out of sync. Case in point, Burko is played by Coyote Shivers. Where does he come from? He's a character. We've never heard of him. And then halfway through the film, he just walks in, and we have to assume he apparently works there. And what's more, he apparently has this rather intimate back relationship with Deb. Also, I'd like to ask, why does he walk around the store that he's supposedly working at with a guitar strapped to his back in most scenes? It feels off, and unfortunately, it's there by design. Same with Eddie. If you're watching the film, and you think that Mark and AJ have this really close relationship with this pizza delivery guy who just shows up well into the movie and clearly acts as a pot connection. But without saying it, we're also supposed to assume that Eddie is also a regular part-time employee here at the store, and everyone just, air quotes, knows it. I mean, he does apologize for being late, and suddenly he's wearing an employee badge. How does that happen? But there's some other glaring problems. This is 90s Baltimore, so I gotta ask sort of a painful question. Where are people of color? There is not a single person who works in this store or who has a main speaking role in this film that is not a Tom Petty level of whiteness. It's a movie about music, and it has and trades on jokes about rap. Which, fine, it was a trite subject for the day, but seriously, in a movie dedicated to talking about rock, blues, and jazz, it seems like it would be a no-brainer that it would think to even feature a character of color who would be able to talk about their love of music, or at least the fact that their culture contributed so strongly to it. This is actually something, though, that would go on to hurt the film later, but I'll be quiet and cross that bridge when we come to it. Now, here's an interesting hill I am going to allow myself to be caught on. When I was a callow youth, I also would look at Rex Manning as clearly one of the bad guys and as a funny character to be mocked. Tens of thousands of celluloid hours later and a good 20 plus years of living on this earth has made me actually far more sympathetic and understanding of him. You see, Rex Manning is a complex character, and I would like to argue he doesn't get a fair shake here. And I mean, as an actor, Caulfield is just so great playing him with a mixture of boredom, frustration, and disgust. Looking Manning now as an aging rock star who supposedly had his heyday in the 80s, and this is his new album release, and it's not the cup of tea of most of the staff at Empire, Corey notwithstanding. But honestly, look at how Rex behaves. He's treated, at best, with simmering disrespect from store employees. He's mocked for his fashion. He's mocked for his music. Clearly his publicist Jane doesn't like him. And the people who show up to see him are mainly older women and effeminate. That's 90s code for gay men. It was 1994. I can't defend it, but I can't change it either. All of this, he isn't happy, but he's trying to deal with it as best he can. And again, all while constantly being directly or unintentionally insulted. So, when he's sitting to have his lunch, and young Corey walks in to interrupt him with her bizarro, nerdy schoolgirl infatuation, and sort of lays it all the line that she wants to and intends to have sex with him, clearly, she's not properly reading the interaction that they're having. And I would argue he does the right thing. I can hear you out there. Stop clutching your pearls. He honestly waves her off like a bad pitch. He questions her age, he questions her motives, and asks if she actually understands the situation that they're in. And then, when she insists on how absolutely serious she is, he calls her bluff. He deliberately scares her, dubiously questioning all this, and then he unzips his fly, which in turn drives her out of the room and allows a smiling Rex Manning to do what he wanted to do in the first place, which was eat his lunch in peace. Now, for you director's cut enthusiasts, hold on, I'll deal with you in a moment. So again, what's wrong with this scenario? Now, if you're gonna try to throw the whole Gina affair at me, fine, let's dance. So, the gentleman is here. He's at the store, he's there for the afternoon, he's doing his signing, he's meeting with fans, completely different staff member, comes up to him, talks to him, flirts with him, treats him like a human being. She talks with him personally, she jokes with him, and then, after all that, when she comes on to him, he goes along for the ride willingly, and he has a tryst with Gina in the back office. Now again, I know, as an audience, we're supposed to be angry with him, and we're supposed to be mad at her, especially since all the employees have this awkward realization that Gina did this out of some sort of dreadful spite towards her friend. But why exactly are we mad at Rex Manning? Take this from his perspective. He's exiting a room in the back and comes out to see a group of eight people who have clearly been monitoring his activities, and rather than getting angry at Gina, well, Corey does, or acknowledging that they shouldn't be there, the staff all focus on him. So when he makes a joke that kind of breaks the ice, when he says, what, no applause? First, he's physically attacked by AJ, and then all in attendance turn and start to insult him personally and start to insult his music. Taking his cheap shot punch aside, what the hell? I don't care what math you're doing here, it doesn't add up. Manning is not the villain in this scenario. How am I supposed to justify this? Am I supposed to support AJ attacking a man who didn't take advantage of the girl he loved, but instead enjoyed the affections of a willing acquaintance? That's okay? What compounds it even more, though, for me, is knowing that in the original, full-length cut of the film, Manning gets to have, well, he's at least allowed to be nicer, or at least he's allowed to become a more relatable human being. As much as these, at least in Lucas's words, these beautiful tattooed gum-chewing freaks are allowed to be able to perceive. There's a deleted scene where he and Burko end up talking outside the store, where Rex is actually explaining what the record company is making him do, and how he's not happy about any of this either. He basically is admitting, it's not fun being a rock star, there's a lot of work you guys don't know about. And while Burko claims, oh, that's never gonna happen to me, man, it does allow Burko to have sympathy for him, and that actually sets up an entirely alternate rooftop concert scene where Rex Manning comes back and he actually joins with the impromptu band and performs with them and helps raise money to save Empire and puts everything right by putting on a show for the public. He ends up performing a more rocking version of his own song where he wins over the crowd and all of the staff. That is, until the police break it up. Now that would have been interesting to see. Now I said all of that, and I'm saying this to you to say this part now, mainly because I know there's some people out there who don't take what I say as gospel. And by the way, good for you. You shouldn't believe everything you hear. We have show notes in the liner for a reason. But you're undoubtedly going to say, yeah, but Chris, if you're going to talk about deleted scenes, why don't you talk about the alternately filmed seduction scene? Because there is one. And it's where Rex is a total jerk and he makes actually a terrible oral sex reference in front of Corey, and that is the thing that sends her running. See, he's not a great guy like you would claim. I know, it was indeed filmed, but it was also not used. So I'm only able to judge based on what was being used, and unless you're going to be viewing the director's cut of the film as gospel, which I don't, again, you'd be correct. But if you're going to take that, you have to then take in the aforementioned good stuff too that I already floated, which also didn't make the theatrical film, which we didn't get to see. So I'm not going to be able to sit here and rationalize a bunch of what-ifs. I'm only going to be able to say I gotta work with what's in front of me. And from what I'm seeing, even with the original recipe of the film's final product that we're left with, this man doesn't deserve all of the hate that's heaped upon him in this film. And for the record, I know they're trying to make fun of it, I know they're trying to mock him, but I'm gonna say no more, Mona Moore. It comes off as having a really fun Billy Idol send-up vibe, and it's actually a cool song to listen to.
Oh, Rexy, you're so sexy.
I love it.
Hi, Rexy.
Hi, Andy. You say I need a little of my hula la. I know you get lonely and you can't get to bed. Well, say no more, baby, I'll be running everywhere. Say no more, come on, I'm on. I'll bring my loving right to your front door. Here I come, baby, it's your time to go. Let's have a kissing, baby.
Personally, for me, I'm actually happy that Rex Manning Day has found its way into the culture as something of a fun and lighthearted thing that fans for the film could glom onto. But I gotta say, I'm a little bummed that the impetus of the selection for the date to make it April 8th was based on the fact that the movie makers decided to tie into Kurt Cobain's suicide, or at least on the day that his body was found, April 8, 1994. In hindsight, I personally feel this is sort of in bad taste. I'll freely admit I don't worship Nirvana by any stretch, but band members and the late Mr. Cobain deserve some level of respect in this world, and they created music that I and so many others do enjoy and view as being important in our lives. So making the day coincide with that, again, in retrospect, to me feels somewhat callous and even sort of mean-spirited. I would personally spin it positive. If you wanted to tie it in with Cobain and how much he meant to us, why don't you make it his birthday? Why don't you make it February 20th? Or tie it to June 15th, when Nirvana's album was first put out in 1989. All that said, it is what it is. So let's be free to reel in some of that Empire Records fandom and have a respectful Rex Manning Day. But all that said, I can hear you out there. Chris, how was this film received? Well, much like last week's offering, it wasn't. Remember how I stated that Regency felt that its version of the film over Moyle's was considered to be safer? That was only partially true, because after all of their edits, and after all of those reshoots and all of the futzing with the story, they still thought it would be a good idea to do a second and even a third run of audience test screenings. In August of 1995, Billboard ran a magazine article touting that there was a new teen comedy that was going to be coming out in September, which was leaning into its indie sensibilities and its musical chops. It was a big article, and it was promising big things. Soup to nuts, Empire Records was going to be a big, splashy opening for Regency, with Warner Brothers acting as the distribution, and they were planning on opening it up to 1,250 theaters nationwide. Regency was getting nervous, though, and wanting to hedge bets, they decided they would have some test screenings set up in the middle of the San Fernando Valley, California, tapping into the teen audience there. Here's the irony. Reactions from the local teens were amazing. They loved it. And for that moment, director Moyle thought, finally, this justifies all of the compromises I made for this movie. But both Regency and Warner Brothers would not relent, and they instead decided to hold one more test screening, this time selecting to show the film in working-class Hispanic neighborhoods, even deeper within the valley. Those teens who viewed the picture did not relate to the characters, nor could they relate to the music, and they panned it in their exit interviews. Now, logically, even a passing glance, at least when you see it from what it is, you'd understand that's not a fair comparison. We're not dealing with apples to apples in this scenario. But Warner Brothers and Regency decided to use the negative feedback to justify their own cold feet. What's somewhat worse, though, is by the time Empire was angling to make its official debut, Clueless, which again had also been filmed the year prior and had been released in July of 1995, was a runaway hit, and it grossed $88 million against its comparable $12 million budget. It was a point that earned producer Nathanson a screaming harangue from his bosses that he would be so thoughtless to turn down a project like it because, quote, we already had a teen movie in the works. Again, one would think cooler studio heads would prevail and somebody would have said, well, hey, this did really well and we have a film that's kind of like that. Why don't we just stay the course? But instead, the die had been cast. Warner Brothers purposely went out of its way to tank the film, and they used the feedback from the Hispanic audiences to justify, look, we don't have people of color in this film. No one's going to like it. Let's get rid of it. They canceled the planned and already widely publicized release, opting instead to dump the film outright. They limited the movie to show on a mere 87 screens nationwide in just 4 shopping malls. Everything about it was designed to make the film a loss so that creative accounting could come in and make things right on the back end. There was no advertising, there was no hype, there were no interviews, there were no press. The film would open for a scant 2 weeks, and even then, it would only gross about $250,000 against its own $10 million budget. Ironically, the film's soundtrack would end up having two hit singles, The Gin Blossoms' Till I Hear It From You, and Edwyn Collins' A Girl Like You. But each of those would later have to go on to be discovered down the line, as the artists would themselves had further success. It was not tied to this movie. Since so few places were showing it, critical reception for the day was virtually non-existent. The only actual printed review I could find, at least from the day, came from Variety's Ken Eisner, who himself was not very complimentary of the film. He called it a soundtrack in search of a movie, noting that it's looking for a bullet to put it out of its box office misery. And he commented that characters are all one note, and only possessing one personality trait each. Eisner did, though, make a distinction to single out Turney's performance as bringing the film some much-needed gravity. Now, here's the thing. Empire Records, though, did not go gently into that good night. Instead, it did what so many films of the day would opt to do. It was a huge movie for rentals. People went to their video stores and saw it. Not Gen Xers, ironically. People, well, my age. Those of us who were turning 13, 14, 15 when this film came out. We're the ones that turned it into the cult powerhouse that it was. And because of those viewings, those repeated viewings, those sharing, this movie took on a life of its own. So much so that Empire Records still thrives as a hit today. Its soundtrack has been reissued on vinyl. People will actually get together and make Rex Manning Day events. Seriously, go on Etsy. It's loaded with all kinds of weird Rex Manning themed merch. Regular screenings of this film get held and fan groups abound. A director's cut of the film would finally be released, and it ended up restoring about 20 minutes of the original 40 that were chopped against director Moyle's wishes. You can pick it up today. Honestly, I have to say I've seen it. The final offering is still a very flawed film. And for my money, with what I want to see, for good or ill, I'm going to stick with the original recipe 1995 theatrical release as the way to go, because it's what I know and like the best. Also, best not to dwell on all of the what-ifs, and instead, focus instead on the flawed magic that already exists on the screen. Falling under the category of everything old is new again, lest you think this film is going to be forgotten anytime soon, if you want to look at the real legs and legacy that Empire Records has, let me tell you this. This very year, in the coming few months, we are going to see a world premiere as Empire Records is going to become a stage musical for Off-Broadway, crafted again by the writings of Carol Heikkinen and now musical direction of Zoe Sarnak. So we have literally a new generation poised to experience Empire Records in a whole new fashion. And I'm going to view that from a distance with some guarded optimism, because it's still a testament to the cultural currency that this film wields. And I think we're all better off for it. The version of Empire Records screened here at the LSCE was the 2015 Blu-ray edition that comes armed with some decent deleted scenes, music videos, and the film's iconic 90s trailer, which can still be found in the wild, although oddly, for a rather hefty price of $31.91 on Amazon.com. Now, the good news is it's been replaced by a newer release, a 2018 release, which has supplanted it with all of the same extras, with additional music videos, but for some reason that version, with different cover art, but the same stuff, clocks in at $9.89 on Amazon as well, which I would tell you is a far better deal for this level of fun. Now, remember folks, we don't get anything here at the LSCE for telling you where you would purchase your films at. We just feel in this day and age, it's ever so important to keep supporting physical media to ensure that these fine companies who own the rights to these amazing films will keep releasing the content that we all know and love. And at the end of the day, isn't that really what it's all about? getting more of that content you know and love? Besides, this film is such a great time capsule for music. It's so timely for the events of the day. And by the way, who wouldn't want to go back and take a wild ride through the optimism that was the mid-90s? I know I do. So what are you waiting for? Get out there and get yourself a copy of Empire Records today. So that's going to wrap things up here for this episode of I Saw It on Linden Street. Thank you so much for joining us. If you like what we're doing here, that would be the LSCE Pooches and myself, please give us a favorable review on Apple Podcasts or hit that subscribe button. Or hey, just do it wherever you're listening to us on. Did you leave us a fun review? Hell, I'll read it here and give you a shout out on the show. Just think of it as my way of saying thank you for recognizing our love of cinema. Please swing by, check out our website, lscep.com, where we have articles, episode links, and comics for you to peruse. We're on Spotify for ease of use. I'm also proud to say we're on Amazon Music, so if you have an account, you can simply turn and say, "Hey Alexa, play I Saw It on Linden Street today." We're also featured on Good Pods, as well as Podchaser. Those are just some podcast databases for listeners and creators alike. Find us there, give us a follow and a review if you could please, and hey, feel free to like any of the lists that we're a part of to give us a boost in the old rankings. More reviews and the increased likes, that affects those marvelous algorithms, and it makes us more searchable. And then we can share these fine films with more people. And you want to do that, don't you? Of course you do! Do you have any questions for us? Any comments? Any movies you want us to cover? Anything you think I got wrong? Well, we want to hear from you. So please, send us an email or an audio clip to lindenstreetcinemaexperience@gmail.com. If you love social media, well, we use it here, at least for the time being. We're on X, formerly known as Twitter, at LSCEP, and you can find us on Instagram, at LSCE_podcast. If you'd like to be even more personable, or you wish to contribute a segment to the sidecar, please send us an audio message by way of Spotify. It's a free and easy app to use, and it's there for you. So until next time, please take care out there, everybody stay healthy and well, and remember, life's too short not to live in the past. Take it easy out there, everybody.
You! Take the lead.
What?
Go on, Gina. Take it.
Folks, it's time to say goodnight. We sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment. Please drive home carefully and come back again soon. Good night.